Hi, everyone. My name is Andrew Campbell. I'm the co-host of the Canadian Podcow. Thanks for listening, along with my friend Sarah Sash. Hi, Sarah.
Good to see you, Andrew. It's been a while.
It has been a long time. How are things in BC as we start our first episode of, can you imagine, the fifth season of the Podcow?
Yeah, how did that even happen? I feel like it was just COVID and we were like getting to know each other virtually. Now we've seen each other all over the place for years. What the heck?
It's one of those things that, like, I'm trying to count because we always do our Christmas episode with your ugly Christmas sweater. Does that mean we've seen ugly Christmas sweaters 4 and very soon 5 times now?
I think so. I'm going to start working on that very shortly, very shortly.
Maybe one season. I don't know if it'll be this one. One season I will join you. But things, the summer was good. Things in BC are going all right.
Well, yeah, we got our corn off super early. I haven't started any of my fall time travel. So, going well. How about you?
We are in the throes of harvest around here.
Thanks for making time.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I sent everybody to fuel up and grease up equipment today so I'll take the seat here in a little while. But yeah, we've got the grain side of our farm is in full swing right now with white beans are the magic crop of the day we're going to pull off.
I've got to come see all these things one day because I have no idea what any of this stuff is.
All the way to Southern Ontario, where it isn't just the stuff to feed livestock. There's grain everywhere around here too. But yes, it would be fantastic to have you around here, Sarah, to take a look at the grain landscape in Southern Ontario. But the political landscape is what we're actually going to talk about today, because as we are in our fifth season, the Canadian government is in their next session, of parliamentary affairs. And it's one of those things where we've got a budget coming out in November from this government. Pierre Poilievre has come back into the House in opposition after he's won his riding. There's a trade war with the United States. There's a lot going on in Canadian politics, Sarah.
There's so much going on. It's pretty hard to keep track of everything, where we're all going. People are all worried about the economy. Jobs are being lost. The impact of the trade war is touching all of us in our wallets and in our heads, I would say. So today we're really fortunate to have a great guest on. We'll bring some clarity about what to expect from the government and from this parliament and what it all means for our sector, especially as CUSMA renegotiations are looming.
Coming up next on the Canadian Podcow.
Our guest today is a veteran political journalist and analyst who appears regularly on television, radio, and podcasts in Canada and abroad. Over 40 years of journalism, he was based in Toronto, Quebec City, Montreal, Ottawa, and Washington. He was the bureau chief of the Canadian Press in Washington, then in Ottawa. He later joined the CBC as managing editor of its parliamentary bureau.
His peers in the Parliamentary Press Gallery gave him the Charles Lynch Award for outstanding contribution to national political coverage. He's also received the Hyman Solomon Award given out by the Public Policy Forum for providing insight into the policy-making process in Canada and explaining how public policy affects Canadians. Today, he is Canada's correspondent for The Economist, Rob Russo. It is fantastic to have you. Welcome to the Canadian Podcow.
It's a pleasure to be here, although after that intro, it sounds like my future is firmly behind me.
Well, Rob, I would not say that. You just got off from telling us that you were in meeting with the Prime Minister yesterday, doing an interview, through your work there. Obviously, have a great role. I've listened to a lot of your, commentary in a lot of different areas, Rob. And it's one where it's exciting to have you just to kind of give, us producers in the industry, everybody in the dairy industry, a little bit of an insight into what the next number of months, number of years look like with Mark Carney at the helm. He's been at the helm for the last few months. Can you kind of give us a bit of a report card here in terms of, what really strikes you about him and his government after the first couple of months?
A few things. Certainly a determination in the first couple of months, particularly the first month after the election, the first month or two, to get two or three things done legislatively quickly before the opposition really had a chance to organize, before Pierre Poilievre had a seat. He got support from the Conservatives on some key pieces of legislation. I think above all would be C5, that's sort of like the major projects bill. He didn't pass a budget, and there's a budget coming that they don't say it's postponed. Initially, they told us it was going to be around the early October. Now it's early November. And that's because things have not gone as they would have hoped in terms of an agreement with the United States to end a tariff war. You know, the campaign was all about how the United States wants to absorb Canada as a 51st state. Donald Trump would love that anyway. And since then, the prime minister has made a bunch of compromises to try and get an agreement with the United States, and one remains elusive. So I think if I was going to suggest where we were, try to paint a portrait of where we were, a government that knows it has to move very, very quickly in terms of diversifying our trade away from the United States. At the same time, it's a government that knows that if we want to maintain our prosperity, our security, our ability to defend ourselves, because in many instances we can't, we need to come to some sort of arrangement with the United States. That arrangement remains elusive. We are in a trade war now, not just with our biggest trading partner, the United States. We're in a trade war with our second biggest trading partner in China, which is really hurting canola farmers in particular in Western Canada. But farmers in general need to be worried about the trade war with China as well. So very difficult circumstances, some grim times in certain places in Canada. I think of Quebec, I think of Sault Ste. Marie, I think of Windsor, you know, places like that, lumber towns that are really, really hurting. So we're facing some grim times. And yet, the government under Carney seems to have the trust of Canadians. It'll be interesting to see how long he's able to maintain that trust, how long he's able to maintain that confidence, and whether or not he's able to get, I think, at least a sectoral deal on tariffs that helps some of those sectors of our economy, steel, aluminum, auto parts, forestry products, that have been pulverized.
So in the context of all this stuff, we had a short parliamentary session, there was no budget, the Liberals seem to be getting their agenda through, they clearly have the confidence of the House, but I'm wondering how stable is the government in your view right now?
I think that we have a strong, stable minority government, to quote Stephen Harper. He's three votes shy, and no government in a minority situation should ever take that for granted. I've stopped dyeing my hair gray, guys, so I am really old. I'm old enough to remember Joe Clark's government falling when it thought that even though it had a fairly robust minority, Mr. Clark said that he was going to govern as if he had a majority and paid the price for it. There is, I would suggest, very little interest for any of the opposition parties in calling an election right now. Quebecers maintain, I think, the most fear, the most worry about what is happening south of the border. So there is no incentive for the Bloc Québécois to go early. The New Democrats are impoverished. They're disorganized. They're leaderless. They have no interest in having an election early either. I would suggest Mr. Poilievre, his party's numbers aren't bad, but his personal numbers remain dismal compared to Mr. Carney. He's facing a leadership review. I think he's going to pass that leadership review, but his future as leader of the party, even with that looming, remains an open question. I think that if any party would be favored, I would suggest it would be the Liberals. And I think the opposition parties know that, and they're not going to bring them down. I suggest that there will be, if there were a confidence vote today, there would be cases of sudden diplomatic flu that would, I think, affect some members of the opposition, and they wouldn't show up in numbers.
Well, you reference Poilievre. Let's talk about him for a little while, because earlier you did mention that there really was no opposition. He wasn't in the House. He lost his seat in Carleton. And so there really was no opposition, you know, Carney had right off the bat. He is back in the House. You kind of hear some of the quotes come out of question period now, with him going back and forth. But I think the challenge is, thinking back to that election, what Canadians thought of him. When we think about, you know, was he too much like Donald Trump? Was he, you know, too aggressive? And was there a need for him to make some modifications to what Canadians thought of him? Do you think that Poilievre does make some of those modifications, or does he kind of, you know, stick to his guns as, you know, really, really what he has been a strong opposition leader, at least?
Yeah, he's an effective communicator, and let's give him some credit. The Conservatives substantially increased their seat count. They increased their share of the popular vote to levels that hadn't been seen since 1988. They attracted votes from areas, segments of the population that I'd never seen since I've been covering politics, particularly among working Canadians, particularly in areas that are union heavy. I'm thinking of southwestern Ontario. They picked up some seats around the GTA. And so there is much that he should see as an accomplishment. But here's what conservatives say to me. They need a million more votes and they don't know where they're going to get them. They are dependent upon confidence crashing in the Carney government. The issue, overriding issue, people say right now it's back to affordability. But I think that can be ephemeral. This morning we're taping something and I heard the President of the United States about an hour ago say once again that he's working on a new missile defense shield for North America and that Canada has called him wanting to join. I assume that means the Prime Minister and that it's going to cost us a lot of money and it would be cheaper if we were just going to be the 51st state. I guarantee you that's going to be a headline in Canada. And Mr. Trump is not going away. He's a fact of life. He is going to continue to say that. That is going to continue to stir the passions of Canadians. And it was the biggest issue during the campaign. I don't think that issue is going away. I really don't. And as long as that's the issue, it's going to be very, very difficult, I think, for Mr. Poilievre to find those million more votes than the 8 million he got that he needs. And that's not me who's saying that. That's conservatives who are saying that. They don't know where those million votes are going to come from under the current scenario.
So is he the right guy then? I mean, not to cut straight to the chase, but against Justin Trudeau, he was flying high. He led to these super high numbers compared to what's happened before. He had a 30-point lead in November. Is he the right person to face Mark Carney in the next election in the current context?
You know, somebody wise in politics that I used to talk to, was kind enough to talk to me when I was a kid reporter, said to me, there are no facts in the future. And if there were, you and me and Andrew would be running down to the corner store to get a 649 ticket to get those numbers that we know are coming. So the truth is, I don't know. I do know that smart conservatives that I spoke to, and I interviewed some of them about a month ago for a piece in the magazine on where the conservatives are after the election, that they just don't see it. They see it being very difficult for the conservatives to form a government if the NDP continues to be a non-factor in elections. Now, the NDP are about to elect a new leader. They are clearly going in a different direction, I think a direction further to the left. And it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Mr. Carney, I think he was described by Danielle Smith in a discussion with my pal Peter Mansbridge as the best conservative prime minister she can remember. So that leaves a vulnerability to the left of the Liberals. Can the NDP take advantage of that? Can they return to numbers that are robust enough that it has an impact on elections? Because, you know, Stephen Harper was a very smart conservative. He knew he had to make a deal with Jack Layton in order to squeeze the Liberals. Because if the NDP's numbers come up, that means that often you're going to have three-way races in ridings, and the Liberals and the NDP split the vote on the left, and conservatives come up the middle with 33, 34, 35% in ridings that they normally would never win. Is Mr. Poiliev canny enough to do that? He certainly wasn't in the last parliament. He did everything he could to insult Jagmeet Singh, everything he could to bash down the numbers. And it worked to a certain extent in that he won a fair number of NDP seats. But at the same time, if he would have worked with Mr. Singh to defeat Trudeau last spring, then we'd be talking about Prime Minister Pierre Poilievre right now.
Well, and speaking of the NDP, I mean, you use the word decimated. You know, in the last election, obviously, you know, they're down to their seven seats. Jagmeet Singh is out as leader. He's resigned. They are looking at picking their new leader in the new year in March. Three candidates have come, you know, kind of declared their intention, at least so far. I guess I'm curious, you know, is it a new leader? Is it something that happens, you know, in the current political context? What does it take to rebuild and reach a level that's at least makes them relevant, you know, when we do talk about, you know, possibility in three-way races in ridings?
Yeah, I'm one of those people who believe it's unlikely that the New Democratic Party is going to disappear. I'll tell you why. Look across the country, there's about 150 New Democrats in legislatures across the country. We have an NDP premier in British Columbia. The most popular premier in the country is Wab Kanu in Manitoba. He's an NDP premier. The NDP remains the official opposition in Alberta and in Ontario. That suggests that there's a bedrock of New Democrats that's going to be very, very difficult to erode on a permanent basis. At the federal level, they have been wrestling for decades between this notion of, are they a party of conscience? Are they there to actually keep the other parties honest? Or are they a party that actually wants to be pragmatic and try to attain power? I mentioned Stephen Harper a few moments ago. He worked with Jack Layton, who believed that that for Democrats to be truly relevant at the federal level, they actually have to threaten to hold power and at some point hold power. And Mr. Layton realized for that to happen, both he and Mr. Harper had a common enemy in the Liberal Party. And Mr. Layton worked with Mr. Harper to disadvantage the Liberals at every opportunity that he got, if it advanced the interests of working people in Canada and the New Democratic Party. I'm not sure that there's a Liberal or a New Democratic leader on the horizon who thinks that way. And as long as they don't think that way, it's going to be very, very difficult for New Democrats to regain some sort of influence in the House. I don't say never. It's going to be a while. You know, Brian Topp, who was the chief of staff to Jack Layton, very smart Democrat, said that the only people who can obliterate New Democrats at the federal level are New Democrats themselves. And he thought that there was a wing of the party that's working hard to do that right now.
So we mentioned the November 4th budget earlier. What can we expect from Mark Carney? He's been talking about the budget of austerity and investments. How is that possible in the current context of Canada? It keeps sounding like we're pledging to lose weight by keeping going to the buffet, if you will.
Yeah, I think we might be up for a great big head fake. Whenever I keep hearing about how tough things are going to be, I generally think that they're setting us up. I think that there are some segments of the economy that are going to be hit very hard. If you're a public servant right now, you've got a great big bullseye on your back. I think that that's an area of federal spending that is going to be pared back. And I think that there will not be an outcry about it. Just look at what's happening with the postal strike. There is not a groundswell of sympathy for postal workers right now, nor is there a clamor in the economy and through the economic chain for the return of the postal workers, or a clamor for legislation to end the strike. And I think that that's kind of emblematic of where those who are paid by the federal government are what they're looking at. I think, if you're a federal public servant, you're in trouble. I think that other departments, he talked about a cut of up to 7.5% in the first year. It's not going to be spread across the government. I think that there are some sectors, for instance, anybody that is working in a department that has to do with transfers, like money to help individuals, you know, CPP, health transfers, that sort of thing, they're not going to be affected. The Defense Department is not going to be affected. So there are areas like that that are cordoned off. So that means other sections of the government are going to get hit harder than 7.5%. Global Affairs Canada, I think, probably has a bit of a bullseye on it. Some other areas like that. So I think you're going to see limited pain, and you're going to see some areas that have a pain coming. But I don't know if this is going to be a great big austerity budget. You know, again, because I've knocked around a fair bit. I was a reporter in 1995 here, when they were compelled to make huge cuts because the IMF was knocking on the door. People didn't want to buy Canadian debt. The bond market was demanding a premium to hold Canadian debt, and we're nowhere near that now. Canada has a AAA rating when it comes to our debt. We have among the lowest, if not the lowest, debt to GDP ratio in the G7. But that doesn't mean that if we don't reverse the trend that we're on now, we're going to be in real trouble. And we don't know how things are going to go with our largest trading partner. If we are in for a recession, a tariff-induced recession, because that's what this really is. There's a lot of money on the sidelines that is not being invested in Canada because capital doesn't know what's going to happen in terms of our relationship with the United States. We're in for a fairly grim winter. I'll be looking for the Prime Minister and the budget to tell us how grim they think that's going to be, how long that's going to last. Because even the Prime Minister says, we can give ourselves more than anybody takes away from us. Well, that's going to take time. It's going to take time probably beyond the horizon of this government. I'll give Carney one thing. He does seem to think outside of the four-year electoral horizon, but in the interim, there is going to be pain. There was pain in 1995. We aren't in the same situation fiscally, but in many ways, we're in a worse situation. As I said, we've got these trade wars going on. And in 1995, as they were beginning to make their cuts, they had an airplane, an economic airplane with a busted rudder, and along came this huge tailwind of great economic expansion that began in the United States, and we were in boom years in the 1990s, and that really helped the Canadian economy. Nobody sees that tailwind that propels the busted Canadian economy along. We're going to have to do that ourselves, and there's going to be some very difficult work for a couple of years to get that done.
Well, I think we do need to take a quick break, Rob. But I think if we do kind of talk about what might be coming up in the next few months and few years, when we talk about the U.S. trade wars, Donald Trump, just kind of everything that is circling us now, I think that'd be a great way to come back. So we will be right back after this quick break.
As Canadian dairy farmers, we follow ProAction, Dairy Farmers of Canada's national quality assurance program with 6 modules. Modules like milk quality, that stands for high standards of milk production, or food safety, producing milk that meets 42 requirements, and animal care, that means caring for every cow. ProAction sets standards of excellence. That's what's behind the blue cow logo. Dairy Farmers of Canada.
And we're back with our guest, Rob Russo, Canada's correspondent for The Economist. Rob, during the election, obviously, the president, Donald Trump, loomed large. He even mentioned just what, his kind of talk this morning as we record this, in terms of that conversation of what annexation, or what, us in the 51st state looks like in his mind. definitely Mark Carney benefited from all that discussion through the election. I think that's one thing that everybody's kind of does agree on. How do you think he's doing now, though, as it kind of does continue, as, you know, his elbows up talk just kind of continues to linger, and we seem to be staying in this holding pattern of not really getting anywhere. You know, how do you think Mark Carney's handling that?
Well, as we're speaking, he has made a series of concessions. The elbows are down. If they're not pinned to his waist, they might be sort of down around the knees right now. But he has made a series of concessions. He had a July 21st deadline for a deal that came and went because Trump ignored his deadline and established his own August 1st. That came and went. The Trump administration complained about the digital sales tax on Netflix and other tech companies. Carney sort of withdrew from that. And then there were the reciprocal tariffs that Canada had put on under Trudeau. The Americans complained about that. And once again, Mr. Carney retreated from those. So as it stands now, we don't have much to show for all of these Carney retreats. Again, I'm hesitant to say more than that because they are talking. They are not just officials, but the president and the prime minister are in frequent contact, texting frequently, not just about trade issues, but about other issues as well. I think Prime Minister Carney has taken the advice that in order to advance Canada's goals, he needs to have a relationship, a personal relationship, that goes beyond the horizon of Canada-US bilateral issues to encompass other areas. In other words, he needs to kind of become the president's pal a little bit. And this is not somebody who wants to be pals with Donald Trump, I can assure you. And so they're establishing that kind of relationship in an effort, I think, to try and advance Canadian interests. So we'll see. We'll see in the next little while. If I were looking for a sign, I would look for a sign that the aluminum tariffs would be the first to be reduced, if not eliminated. The biggest selling vehicle, if it's either number one or number two, depending on the month, in the United States is the Ford F-150 truck. And if you want to buy a Ford F-150 truck in the new model year, that's already begun, you're paying a lot more because of tariffs on Canadian steel and in particular Canadian aluminum. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary in the Trump administration, has said that he's sympathetic to the automakers who are making this argument. That would suggest that Canadian aluminum would be the first sector to see its tariffs reduced. I would imagine the Prime Minister is working hard to get others reduced as well. And I think that they're still trying to get a broader deal as well. Negotiated might be a bridge too far. But those discussions are going on. But right now, it looks like the Prime Minister has retreated on a whole bunch of things and as of yet hasn't gotten rewarded for it.
So ever since he was elected and long before he took office, Trump's priority has been focused on trade and the trade deficit and tariffs as the main thrust of his economic policy. These priorities are so important to him that he completely changed the trade relationship between the U.S. and seemingly every other country on Earth. Yeah. Is he winning at this?
Well, there is an alarming number of countries that have decided, yes, we are going to pay to get access to the U.S. market. I think that Canada, under both Prime Ministers Trudeau and Carney, were hoping that they would be part of a like-minded group of countries, including the Europeans, the Japanese, the Koreans, who would come together and say, no, we're not going to do that. We are not going to pay. Canada, as it turns out, was alone in, I think, apart from China, in applying reciprocal tariffs. The other countries never did. So Canada was like that guy in the World War I movies who goes over the top of the trench and says, come on, guys, let's go after them. Let's take them on. And they start to run and they look around and they turn around and there's nobody there. They're on their own. So is Trump winning? Well, right now, it seems everybody is paying for access to the most lucrative market in the world. So where does that put Canada? Canada is a country that sends more than 3/4 of its exports to one country, the United States. Canada is also a country that, despite what most Canadians think, cannot defend itself. We cannot project our sovereignty through the use of force in great swaths of our north. So, we need to make a deal. Right now, our economy is based on north and south. Railways, roads, and those are important, okay? We have access to 340 million of the richest people in the world, the most lucrative market in the world still, by rail and by truck. We don't have to go across an ocean. We don't have to get in an airplane to get to these people. And that, in a way, has made many of our industries complacent. But at the same time, it's made us very prosperous and very secure. We are now discovering the cost of that. So is Trump winning? I'd have to say right now, yeah, he is.
So, and I guess because there is still all this conversation, people do want to think that while we should look beyond the American economy, we should be exporting to other places around the world. Personally, I always struggle with that. You know, as long as it's the easiest, that's where we'll end up. But I guess I'm just kind of curious through all that analysis, the idea of what a trade deal could potentially look like. Is it a case of the relationship between Canada and U.S. has changed forever, or do you think it's changed while Donald Trump is at the helm?
This is a really interesting question. I'm actually surprised that the Prime Minister and the people around him seem to believe that this is a permanent change, that it's a change that will outlast Trump, that will outlast Democrats or Republicans. Even if a Democratic president came in, they don't believe that this is going to go back to a multilateral, or global kind of trade situation where the next U.S. president, even if he or she were a Democrat, would return to that. And there might be something to that, but there have been periods in the United States history where they have withdrawn, where they have tried to close out the rest of the world. There was a period during the 1850s, the know-nothings, where the very nativist kind of bring up the drawbridge, no to immigration, this sort of thing. The United States was born out of a revolution. They are revolutionary people. But they're also people who take in these great big kind of changes that seem to be extreme. They consume them, they digest them. And then in the words of the great Umberto Eco, a wonderful Italian writer, they burp them out. and they come back to being kind of leaders and entrepreneurs, just dynamic when it comes to their capitalism, but a little bit more reasonable. Again, nobody knows, but I am surprised to the extent to which the Prime Minister and the people around him believe that this is a permanent change, that this isn't just a pause. As in the words of the Prime Minister, it's a rupture. I'm not sure I agree with him, but again, we're looking into the cloudy and cracked crystal ball of global politics.
Well, this is the Canadian Podcow, and one of the president's ongoing obsessions has been dairy. He's been complaining and making things up about Canada being unfair, as he does, but more fundamentally, I'm wondering, why is dairy so important to the United States in trade negotiations with Canada? Why is this always a thing?
Because the dairy industry tends to be centered in swing states like Wisconsin. That's one big reason why. And it's also true. We are erecting trade walls to protect our industries, our food supplies. Whether you agree with that or not, I think when I spoke to your larger group in the summer, I suggested to them that it appears to be the mirror image of what Donald Trump believes. Donald Trump believes it's in the national security interest of the United States to have homegrown industries in certain sectors of the economy. I think what the dairy industry is saying, rightly or wrongly, and could be saying to Trump in response, is it's in the national security interests of Canada that it control its own food supply. It would seem to be an argument that is coherent with the argument Donald Trump is making, and perhaps one that he might actually see as a light bulb moment.
So how is the Canadian dairy sector and supply management perceived south of the border? Has Donald Trump been effective in changing that perception and making, I mean, it sounds reasonable to me that we're, the mirror analysis, we're basically offering the same thing, we're connecting food security. Is that what Americans think about what we're doing, or has Donald Trump been effective in changing that perception?
You know, I worked for the Canadian press as their Washington person for a long time. And I learned a humbling fact that apart from the occasional Arctic blast, we were rarely thought of by Americans. You know, we have now been supplanted by Mexico as their largest trading partner. We're a close second, and it's also true that there are great swaths of the U.S. administration, whether you're at the Pentagon, Commerce, USTR, great swaths of the U.S. government that are concentrating on the Canadian relationship, but most people in the United States, including in the administration itself, not in government but in the administration, don't really think of Canada. We don't come up very much. We're at best an afterthought. We are the genial uncle who lives in the attic of the continent, according to them. So I would say that apart from, lumber associations, which are very powerful in the United States, and with the dairy lobby in the United States, most Americans don't think of us at all, but they do see us as a threat. They do see us as unfair traders and unfair marketers. They do see us as protecting our own industries, and that means that their access to our market is cut off unfairly. I don't know how you make that argument with a straight face, though, given that you're openly extorting countries to pay pay extortion rates in order to have access to the U.S. market. You're accusing Canada of doing the same thing that you're doing on a broader scale.
Now, probably the most common question I get, Rob, whether it's with my, kind of dairy peers or anybody once they realize here I am a dairy farmer, is how worried am I about CUSMA negotiations that are, obviously going to, and already are really kickstarting with, the first phase. It's one of those where obviously in Parliament there has been, complete support in terms of we will not give up anymore in terms of supply management access. I don't necessarily hold that completely as fact, given that obviously it's been something they've talked about before and they've, used as we will support it until they don't. So I guess I'm going to ask you the question that I get asked all the time is, how do you think Canada is going to navigate this need that our legislators have said we will not give up any access, and the Americans have said in order to get any deal, you will have to give us something?
Look, Canadians are hoping to rag the puck so that they don't have to make difficult decisions on things like dairy. They're hoping for two or three obstacles to the Trump trade agenda. The first one was the courts. And up until now, the courts have proven to be an obstacle for President Trump. But it's clear that this is an issue in terms of whether or not he has the right to apply some of these tariffs without congressional approval. That's going to end up in the lap of the Supreme Court. And I think that the Trump administration is working on a way to reverse engineer the application and the reasoning for these tariffs so that the courts are not going to be an enduring obstacle. I think the second obstacle Canada is hoping, so that they don't have to deal with supply managed markets, is the midterm elections. And I think that President Trump has shown that he's worried enough about the impact that the midterm elections would have on his agenda. That I think that's reflected in the vigor with which he's supporting the gerrymandering of seats in places like Texas so that he gets five more seats in a conservative state like that. And the final obstacle, of course, I don't think would help Canada, but it is the fact that that the president is term limited to 2028. I don't think we're going to be able to escape some sort of reckoning on Kuzma before 2028, but that's the final obstacle. The first two coming into force, one I think is going to be avoided by the Trump administration. The second one, nobody knows. So where does that leave an organization like the Dairy Farmers of Canada? Well, you're vulnerable. Without a doubt, you know, we talked about federal public servants having a big bullseye on their back. Dairy farmers in Canada have a big bullseye on their back. The Trump administration has for years had a sort of bone in their throat about all of this. In the last round, I think that there was more room given under the quota to U.S. Dairy suppliers. They've never come close, it seems, to taking up the room that's there, and that's because they're right. There are punishing tariffs there, although I think Trump, in his own way, has fantastical exaggerations of what the tariff is. I think he's talked about 400%. It's not 400%. I believe it's between 250 and 300%. Either way, it's a sizable tariff, but they're coming for you. And it'll be interesting to see if the government's resolve holds, given the threat to our prosperity and our security, if there is no trade deal. You know, like, kudos to your lobbyists. They have done a very, very good job in getting that legislation through Parliament that commits every party to keeping the supply managed system in place. But is there a scenario where Canada caves? I think there's a scenario in which they allow more U.S. dairy products into the country. Is there a scenario where the entire industry is left exposed? I don't see that. I don't hear that from anybody that I speak to around the prime minister or the prime minister himself.
So whether it is, you know, around more access to the Canadian market or, you know, a change in who is allowed to import the TRQs and things like that, that are certainly the discussions around the policy. At the end of the day, in order for that to happen, there has to be a deal, would be certainly my thought anyway. And it really is one of those challenges of, if you look at how other countries have come up with deal, they've still included tariffs, they've still included a lot of things that people have wondered, you know, is it really a deal worth having? So I guess that's my kind of question to you now, is in the context of not just dairy, but an entire, you know, trade deal, is having a deal at any cost worth having it? Or is it a case of we still do continue to rag that puck for as long as we can do it, even if it means we don't have a deal?
I don't think any politician is going to say a deal at any cost. Certainly not at a cost to our sovereignty, certainly not at a cost to our economic sovereignty, certainly not at a cost to our ability to make our own decisions about our security and prosperity. That being said, when you speak to the people who are at the table, I ask them what their number one priority is, and they say the number one priority is to maintain low cost or no cost access to the most lucrative trade market in the world, and that's the United States, a trade market that has helped Canada achieve the prosperity and security that it has now. So I interviewed Tim Hodgson a few weeks ago, and I said to him, I quoted that figure of about 77 or 78% of our exports going to the United States, and the dollar terms that that's worth to the Canadian economy versus what we send to the Pacific and to Europe. And I said, okay, at the end of a Mark Carney government, where do you think those numbers are going to be? And of course, he said, I'd like to see those numbers in dollar terms stay the same or go higher when it comes to the United States. I just like to see this expansion on this side when it comes to the rest of the world. And that's what he's working towards. So there is no threat of or no intention of turning our economy away from the United States. There is a great desire for this diversification. But it just isn't going to be easy. We are going to have to, I think, in the interim, accept that there's going to be pain. I remember something that Stephen Harper said during the election campaign when he was, he said that, you know, he's saddened by what has happened with Donald Trump. I think that he was somebody who, when Trump first came along in 2016, might have a positive impact in terms of disrupting things. He's changed his mind on that. The important thing Mr. Harper said as he went on was, I would do anything in my power, including impoverish Canadians if necessary, to maintain the sovereignty of Canada and Canadians. And I think that that's true. So when you ask me, you know, what's the limit? There are limits. But what's the goal? The goal is to maintain low cost or no cost entry to that market. That is a priority. No matter what the plan is for diversification, we will be in very, very grim circumstances. But if you listen to Harper, I think smart prime ministers know that you've got to be prepared to pay that price for your independence.
So finally, Canada, as you've mentioned, has been scrambling to move ahead with this diversification. Do you see any prospect of meaningful inroads with this, or are we stuck with the U.S.? These efforts are just more for show about domestic policies and won't actually change that much here in Canada.
No, just look at the amount of time the prime minister is spending abroad. And look at what he's trying to do. Like, he knows that some of these big projects that he wants to get off the ground won't happen unless international capital flows into the flows into Canada. And some of it might be U.S. capital as well. Like, a lot of these big projects, a lot of these big infrastructure projects, for instance, are in the middle of nowhere. They need roads. They need to build plants and other infrastructure. They need hydro or other kinds of power to get energy to these places in the middle of nowhere. And so that's going to require a great deal of international capital. They need to do this. If Carney's going to go ahead with some of these projects that will make us more of an east and west trading country as opposed to a north and south trading company, they're going to need international capital. So they're serious about trying to do it. But there's a lot of money on the sidelines outside of the country waiting to be invested that is staying on the sidelines because Donald Trump keeps threatening us. And I think that that is part of Trump's plan. Whether we sort of fall to heel or not, the threat of those tariffs is keeping a lot of this investment money on the sidelines. And as that happens, our economy doesn't grow. It gets smaller. I mean, just look at what happened in the second quarter of 2025. Our economy shrunk by almost 2%. So, you know, things could get grim before they get better. They are serious about diversifying. It's going to take a long time. And it's also going to take, I think, some sort of arrangement with the United States to signal to the rest of the world that Canada will be a good place to invest over the next 5, 10, 25 years with some of this money.
Well, it certainly is a time that does come with lots of uncertainty, unfortunately. That is the way the environment we are in. But I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and just kind of give both ourselves and the rest of the industry a little bit of perspective of where that uncertainty comes from. So, Rob Russo, it's a pleasure.
And I hope you come back to me in a little while and I can give you better news.
Well, and you know what? And we'll go through and we'll check everything you are right on, which I'm assuming is all of it. So it'll be perfect, Rob. We'd be happy to have you. Thanks very much for the time today.
It was my pleasure.
Well, that very eloquently sums up the last chapter in Canada's political roller coaster, and of course, the ongoing trade chess match with the United States. Pretty insightful conversation. I feel so fortunate to have had Rob on.
It is, and is one of those where it just, you know, that there are a lot of uncertainties, and it is one of those where, you know, I don't feel that as much as there is uncertainty and there is struggle within, you know, certain elements of the economy, I think it is one of those things where we can kind of go back and forth and say, oh, no, it's not just us that worries as an industry. You know, kind of everybody's in the same boat just trying to figure out what this landscape looks like.
I think it's really helpful for us as farmers to have some context about that, because it can feel sometimes like we're the only ones and it's a big drama. So it's really nice to have a guest like that. We'll keep watching how the Carney government plays its cards and navigates these troubled waters, especially with a minority government.
Especially with a minority government. But as Rob said, it seems like a very solid minority. You know, in the context, you never know how long that lasts. But at least for a little while, it seems like this is the direction we're heading.
Indeed, any direction would be great. So that's it for this episode of the Canadian Podcast. We'd love to thank you for joining us again.
And if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it on social media networks or give us a follow. We're on the network Blue Sky, Facebook, and X. We're always happy to hear from you as well. You can email us at podcast@canadianpodcast.ca.
And huge thanks to our sponsor, the Dairy Farmers of Canada, and our wonderful production team, Bruce Sargent and Carl Bellanger, and of course, to our guest today, Rob Rousseau.
Can't wait to catch you next time on the Canadian Podcast.